Joining me on the line is Professor Daniel Hammermesh from the Department of Economics at the University of Texas at Austin. Professor, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me this morning.
Professor, I'm looking at a book that you wrote that was recently published called Beauty Pays, Why Attractive People Are More Successful. I want to talk about that in a few moments, but for the benefit of our listeners, can you tell them a little bit about the University of Texas at Austin and what you do over there?
Sure. The University of Texas at Austin is the flagship school of the University of Texas system. I think we have 51,000 students. I think it's the second or third biggest university in the U.S. I've been a professor here now for 19 years. I teach various courses, including introductory economics, in what is in fact the biggest section in the university. I teach 550 freshmen every fall. And
wow.
I've been a professor of economics at various places for the last 43 years.
Now, the book was fascinating because I've seen a lot of studies over the years where results have shown that taller people make more money than shorter people and so on, which is obviously more easily identifiable when you say, well, how tall is somebody? Well, there's a finite number. This is how tall they are. When you say, how beautiful is somebody? Obviously, like the old saying goes, it's in the eye of the beholder. But in fact, after reading your book, I see that's not exactly the case, that you can quantify beauty. I want to start from the beginning, in the preface.
That is the beginning.
That is the beginning.
Yeah.
You say that, and this is on page Roman numeral 10, I was not the first to look at the relationship between beauty and economic outcomes. That's an old topic. I was, however, the first to examine it using a nationally representative sample of adults and to do so in the context of economic models of the determination of earnings. This is something called pulchronomics, is that right?
Yeah, it's a term a friend of mine made up. Nobody else did use it until I started using it. It's now becoming more widespread.
Okay. It might not be in Webster's, but it might be in Urban Dictionary online, right?
Well, I think it will be in a couple of years, yeah.
Okay, all right, got it. Okay, so this is the study of pulchronomics, which is the economics of beauty. What interested you in this topic?
When I first came across these measurements of beauty, I said, wouldn't it be fun to think about how this affects economic outcomes? And once I realized that people tend to agree on beauty, it means beauty is scarce, and economics is about scarcity. That's what we deal with in markets.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started thinking about the various markets in which this scarce commodity, beauty, might affect the outcomes. That's why I'm interested. It's a basic economic topic once you start thinking about it.
Okay. And in fact, as you say on page 15, there is one person that most folks can agree on who might be better looking than others, and that's George Clooney. Is that right?
I think most people, except I discovered an outlier, namely my younger sister, who doesn't think he's good looking, but most people certainly believe he's very good looking. I had asked three women of different ages to name the three best looking men in the world, and all three named George Clooney. So I think people agree about him pretty much.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And another interesting part of this study is that, or should I say an interesting part of your book, because your book relied on various studies throughout the years, and I guess the main one was one done by the University of Michigan in 1971, is that right?
That's one set of data the University of Michigan produced, but I mean, at this point, it's not one or even several sets of data. This has been done in different ways, in different countries, in different contexts, many times, so I think it's pretty ubiquitous by now.
All right. The scale that's used, the rating scale or rating scheme, that's a 5-to-1 scheme, right?
Well, that's one of the schemes that's been used very frequently, but I've seen others sort of rate them on 11-to-1 scale, or I did one 10-to-1 once. There have been all kinds. As long as you use some specific numerical schemes with bounds on the ends and you tell people what these things mean, people will give consistent ratings of others' beauty.
Mm-hmm. Is the 5-to-1 scale the most common?
Because it was first started in 71 by the folks at the University of Michigan Survey Research Center, it's been used more than any other, yes. But again, there's no particular reason to use it other than custom.
Okay. And of course, 5 is strikingly handsome or beautiful, 4 is good looking, 3 is average looks, 2 is quite plain, and 1 is homely. And most people, as I found out, fall into that average range, right?
About half or a little bit more of the people in these samples are rated as average, yes.
Okay. That stays the same when we look at different cultures also, right? As you say on page 23.
Certainly there's a consistency within cultures and across cultures. The one difference is in different countries, people are nastier about others' looks than in other countries. In the U.S., we tend to be fairly nasty. Certainly in China, in one set of data that I used, I think only a few percent were rated below average or homely. Most people were rated average. So it does differ from country to country, but there's a consistency across countries in how people are rated.
Mm-hmm. There's a quote here on page 36 that I want to read. It says, "You can't make a silk purse out of a sow's ear." Right? Can you tell the listeners why that's applicable to this study?
Very simply, if beauty were easily changeable and I knew beauty paid off, I'd be doing something to make myself better looking to get better outcomes. In my own case, that would mean getting hair implants since I don't have too much hair.
Right.
Much research on this, but what there is, a study of mine of spending money on makeup and cosmetics and a Korean study of plastic surgery, both of these suggest that you can't really make yourself very much better looking by spending money on your appearance. This doesn't mean you oughtn't do it. I mean, if it makes you feel better to buy fancy clothes or to get a nose job, that's fine. But it's not going to make your appearance that much higher rated in the eyes of others. So in that sense, if you're a sow's ear, you're not going to become a silk purse.
Right. Which is probably disappointing to the folks who are spending, I think you quoted something like $12 billion a year in the United States on plastic surgery.
Well, I'm not sure it is. I mean, if they think they're going to become better looking and do much better because of that, then yes, it's disappointing. But if they realize they're just doing it to make themselves feel better, then they shouldn't be disappointed, and it means it's a valuable expenditure for them.
Right. Now, there's a couple more quotes that I found interesting, and another one is on page 55, mm-hmm. where you actually quote Einstein. And Einstein said, of course, it is easier to split an atom than a preconception. Again, how is that applicable to your study?
Well, for example, one of the things that's been found in the literature, not always, but in the majority of studies, is that the impacts of beauty on earnings are larger for men than for women. And most people find that very hard to believe, and that's the preconception that is very hard to shatter.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's reasons for this, and reasons why, if you think about it, it's not so surprising, but it is hard to get people to think about it in those terms.
Okay. And there is one more quote on page 57.
Uh-oh.
Yep. It's a quote, but it was from a sign you saw in a country store in Texas that said, "Housework makes you ugly." Now, why don't you explain to our listeners why that's particularly applicable to this study?
Well, the finding that would fit the Einsteinian quote was that the effects of looks on women's wages are less than those of men. And the question is why? And our thought, and I think this is mine plus a co-author's thought, was that if you're a guy and you're bad looking, you know your looks are going to hurt you, but you still work. Guys, even now, are almost all going to work. And so you'll see guys who are pretty ugly in the workforce. Even today, not all women work in the market for pay. And if you're a bad looking woman and you know that your looks are going to hurt you, you need not work. And in fact, we find that bad looking women, the bottom seventh or eighth, are about 10 percentage points less likely to be working than the top third of women ranked by their looks. In other words, you get out, you select out of the labor force bad-looking women. So it's not that housework makes you ugly. It's rather that if you're ugly, you're more likely to be doing housework.
Now, there is an ugly side to all of this. And the ugly side is that looks actually do have an impact on how much money you're going to make. You came up with some figures based on these studies on page 47, where you said that the maximum amount of money that someone would earn extra earnings for being good looking instead of bad looking would be about $230,000. Is that right?
That's about right, and that's about 15% difference over one's lifetime between maybe the top third of lookers and the bottom seventh of lookers. So, you know, it sounds like a lot of money, $230,000. It is a lot of money.
Right.
But compared to the impact of going to college instead of just graduating from high school, it's substantially smaller. It's a big amount, but there are other things that are even bigger.
Right. And like you said, education is the biggest, right?
That's the biggie, of course.
You say on page 46, by far the most thoroughly examined determinant of earnings is education.
Yep.
And you even list how much you would make average for each year of education. So it is substantial,
right.
Of course.
It's huge.
But here you looked at individual occupations and how somebody's looks would impact the occupations, how much money they made in those occupations. You looked at prostitutes, politicians, which a lot of people would say the same thing, and
indeed.
And MBAs. Tell our listeners about the findings on those.
Well, it's not just those three occupations. There have been a whole bunch of specific occupations
right. Where
looks affect your earnings. And for prostitutes, it's really substantial. Perhaps that isn't surprising. For politicians, the results are really neat. And this has been done in the U.S., Finland, Australia, Germany, probably a few others, too. Better-looking politician has the better chance of getting elected. It doesn't matter much for the presidential election here, because after a while you're focusing on what the people have to say, what they stand for. But the lower down the ballot a race is, the more important the relative looks of the candidates are, unless there's an incumbent. If there's an incumbent, looks don't matter so much because you know more about the candidates. You know one is the incumbent and you'll tend to vote for her more likely. Mm-hmm. But if the race is all new people and low down the ballot, looks matter tremendously for politicians.
Okay, and MBAs?
MBAs, there have been a couple of studies of that, and no question the better-looking MBA gets a job. What I think is surprising about all this, looking at different occupations, is that there are many occupations which you think looks wouldn't matter. Even there, the better-looking people do better in a variety of ways.
Right, like quarterbacks.
Well, quarterbacks, I don't know, insofar as the team might be more likely to be inspired by a good-looking quarterback, that doesn't surprise me. What surprises me is my own occupation of professors.
Okay.
Where the good-looking professors, students just will give them higher ratings, which I find very unfortunate since I don't view myself as that good-looking. I think the students would love me more if I were good-looking.
Right. And, of course, there is a website that you mentioned in the book called RateMyProfessors.com, right?
What's neat about that website, RateMyProfessors.com, is that they now give chili peppers if enough students rate the professor as hot. They didn't do that initially, and I do believe they started it right after my first study on beauty of professors came out, and I think they got the idea from our research. So it's a case where something in the real world was directly influenced by academic research. I'm not sure influenced for the better, but it has been influenced.
Right, exactly. At least people are able to express their opinions about something.
I think that's probably a good thing. I'm not 100% sure.
Right. I want to get to this. When I read it, it made me a little sad because people who are considered ugly by other folks, by the majority of folks, I guess,
sure,
are also not as happy. Is that right?
Yes. In fact, the neat thing is that line in the book, regrettably, there had been very little research on it. I mean, I was able to quote one study of a representative sample of people. Since then, I've done substantial additional work on this and much more careful work, and I'm absolutely convinced that's the case, that there's a goodly difference in the degree of happiness, everything else the same, between good-looking people and not very good-looking people.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, that quote is on page 174, mm-hmm. Beauty is only skin deep. But ugly goes clean to the bone. Yeah.
That's Dorothy Parker, who was wonderful in my view.
Right. Another fascinating part of the book was on page 62, when you were talking about how you were contacted by some attorneys.
You're the first person in all the interviews I've done in the last almost 2 months to ask about that. You know that? I'm amazed. Good for you. Thank you.
Sure. I actually read the book, so maybe that has...
Okay, well, I think others do too, but for some reason, this just did not turn them on.
Oh, no, this is fascinating, because on page 62, you say that as soon as the first beauty study I wrote was made public and drew attention from the media, I began receiving calls from attorneys involved in personal injury cases. Please tell the listeners about that.
Well, in many cases, a huge industry where somebody is injured in an accident which is allegedly caused by somebody else. Let me give you an example. A couple of cases I've done, some kid gets bitten by a dog and disfigured. And what's been done is many times they'll sue, and some plaintiff's attorney will argue there's psychological and other damages. What they realized, these plaintiff's attorneys, was that because of the disfigurement, the child is now less good-looking, and having seen our research that bad looks will lower your earnings, they realized that there's an additional loss, namely the lost lifetime earnings because of the dog bite, for example. And so the question is, how much is the loss in earnings? And I've been asked a number of times to calculate that out so that they can add that to the potential damages they might recover.
Incredible. And of course, as you say in one of the chapters of the book, there's a great possibility that ugly people might become a protected class along the lines of other protected classes in, for example, the Americans with Disabilities Act. Is that right?
Yes. I mean, in a couple of jurisdictions already, bad-looking people are protected in employment and housing based upon appearance. That's true in the District of Columbia. It's also true in a couple of small jurisdictions in California. Also true in the country of France. So I think it's quite possible that someday we might consider making this available on a national basis. And I would argue, frankly, that logically, I see no reason why it shouldn't be made available. Logically.
Right. Could there be the possibility for abuse? Let's say if somebody saw those figures, about $250,000, they might say, you know what, I'm going to purposefully get my face disfigured so I can make some money. Do you think that's something that...
No, I can't imagine that happening, because if you disfigure yourself, you might recover the money, but in the meantime, you've also guaranteed that you will suffer a penalty in wages. So at very best, you're going to break even, even if you're certain of recovering. So no, I don't see anybody taking advantage of it in that regard, not at all.
Without knowing what you just said, there's a possibility that they might do it, because you're looking at it logically. They might not look at it logically.
They might, although certainly if you did that, I'm sure the courts would say, gee, this is a fraud, get out of here.
And another area that's fascinating is how somebody's looks actually impact companies' sales and their profits. Explain that, please.
Well, that's the whole key to all this. I mean, no company is going to pay you more if you're good looking unless they benefit from your looks. So the question is to what extent companies do benefit. Regrettably, there's not very much research on that topic. The only couple of studies suggest, though, that companies do benefit substantially. Everything else the same. A company will sell substantially more if it has better looking people out there working for it.
Amazing. The term lookism on page 102, which is pure discrimination in favor of the good looking and against the bad looking, is a term in the vernacular, lookism?
It's in the vernacular more than pulchronomics.
Okay.
I've seen it used in print a few times. I did not create this. I think many years ago some journalist used it, in fact, when I was talking with them. And my guess is it's substantially widely used now.
Okay. On page 159, you talk about a lawsuit. I guess it was against Abercrombie & Fitch. How is that applicable to this study?
Well, they were sued for discrimination generally. Afterwards, they started putting out directives to their management saying, put the hot salespeople up front and promote them, which is not illegal because bad looks are not a protected class. My point on that is that if that were done and if bad looks were a protected class, like this handicaps disabilities, and Abercrombie & Fitch or some other company did that, they would be very much liable for being hauled before a court and class action suit, and that would be pretty good evidence that, in fact, they had engaged in discriminatory behavior along the lines of looks.
Mm-hmm. Now, all this ties into today, actually. The reason being, because the United States is, pretty much everybody knows, going through a severe economic recession. Some would call it a depression. It's been called the Great Recession. It's hard to know exactly how you could classify it, but the fact of the matter is that many jobs have been lost, and the United States has never seen this type of situation before in the modern era. I read on page 50, I believe it was, and page 177. On page 50, you say that beauty might help a good-looking worker more during a recession. And on page 177, you say one solution, of course, the solution to minimize the impact that looks might have on somebody's earning potential. One solution is to try to keep unemployment as low as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Tell our listeners how that's all applicable to your study.
Well, the real question is that beauty and really any other characteristic that might be discriminated against, is the problem worse in bad times or in good times? And the argument is in bad times, employers have their pick of the litter, as it were. And if they don't want to hire bad-looking people, they have more chance to do that. In good times, often you'll take whoever you can get. And in fact, there hasn't been much looking at this, but one of our studies did show, this is for attorneys, that when the labor market for attorneys is very tight, very few jobs, even the bad-looking workers get about the same pay as the good-lookers. So it is pretty clear that in bad times, bad looks hurt you more. The question then becomes, if we had good times more, would people get used to hiring the ugly at the same rate of pay and get over their discriminatory behavior toward the ugly? I like to think that's the case. That's an argument that's been made in favor of low unemployment to help out African Americans. My guess is it would have some help, but it would take an awful long time of full employment before we got over this habit of paying the bad-looking people less.
So they have to suffer through that, too, in this environment.
Well, I don't think this infection helps the bad-looking. I think for some minorities, not all, but for some minorities, of which the bad-looking are one, a recession is especially detrimental.
Let me just move to a different topic real quick, because you are an economist. Do you have some ideas about the shape of the U.S. economy, where it's heading?
Well, I think, you know, everybody says we're in a recession. I would argue we're in a slow, long recovery period from a very deep recession. Moreover, it's a recession which is unlike any other we've had in the post-war period. It's like the Great Depression in that it combined both a cyclical decline because of overexpansion, but also a financial meltdown, which was unprecedented in the last 60 years. And together, these things created not the highest unemployment in the last 60 years, but certainly the longest period of unemployment. And most seriously, this recession, unlike any previous recession, and people don't even pay attention to this enough, has been especially concentrated on a relatively small number of people. The fraction of people who have been unemployed for a long period of time is much higher in this recession than in any previous recession since World War II. And that's the most disturbing thing about it.
With the protests now spreading around the world, what started as a very small protest in New York City with 12 people has now spread globally. And many of these folks are interested in changing the way the monetary system functions with the rest of the population. Of course, they call themselves the 99%. What are your views about doing away with, for example, the Federal Reserve?
That's really remarkable because the same people on the right wing, the Ron Paul types, also want to do away with the Federal Reserve. So you go full circle from lefties to far righties. The Federal Reserve guarantees monetary stability. It's done a tremendous job, Ben Bernanke has, in the last 5 years. And one of the best ways to really plunge this economy in this country further down the tubes is to do things like that. So that's a terrible idea.
Okay.
I'm a mainstreamer who has very liberal tendencies on social issues and quite moderate ones on economic issues.
Mm-hmm. I could tell.
Which I think is quite common for a lot of economists.
I think so. Is there anything else that we perhaps didn't touch or that I didn't touch upon?
You missed one thing. You didn't talk about the marriage market at all. The question there is, just like in the job market, beauty is scarce when you look for a spouse. So there are really two questions here. One, are better looking people more likely to be married than bad looking people? And the answer is only very slightly. And the reason is, you think about, let's say you're really bad looking. You know it's going to hurt you in getting a spouse, but there's somebody for you somewhere. And just like a person of very few skills, most of the time they will get a job. It may not be a very good one. So, you know, there's somebody for almost everybody. So looks doesn't affect whether you get married. Mm-hmm. What it does do, it affects whom you marry. And it's especially true for women. In the market for spouses, women, much more than men, trade their looks for economic characteristics. A couple of papers have shown now that a good-looking woman will marry a spouse, a man who can earn substantially more than a bad-looking woman's husband will earn.
And I do remember reading that. It just wasn't something that I, one reason or another, didn't write down there. But thank you for bringing it up, because that is very important.
It's quite neat. And the neat thing there is, unlike the job market, where looks matter more for men, in the spouse market, looks matter much more for women. So these things are carried different in different markets. It depends which one you're talking about.
Right. If some of the listeners are interested in picking up the book, which they should, because this is something very important, where can they do that? Where's the best place for them to go?
They either contact Princeton University Press or get it on Amazon.com at a ridiculously low price.
Right. And of course, that's Beauty Pays, Why Attractive People Are More Successful. And of course, it is on Amazon. And you have a website also?
Just Google Daniel, D-A-N-I-E-L, last name Hammermesh, H-A-M-E-R-M-E-S-H, and it'll come up and my website's available.
Right. Of course, you had an article in the New York Times when the book came out.
Yes, it was an op-ed piece.
The title, Ugly, You May Have a Case, that's what we talked about earlier. Daniel Hammermesh, economics professor at the University of Texas at Austin. I want to thank you so much for the time you spent explaining all this to the listeners, and looking forward to talking to you in the future.
Great. Thanks for having me.